Salman Matan, Shiram Motadubala, Stephanie Rizzou,
Present.
Christian Tarala,
Present.
Wendy Treating,
Present.
and Ann Adamson.
Here.
Yeah. I'm now going to read a land acknowledgement and then we'll be moving into business of the day. We acknowledge the land on which Cornell University operates. For thousands of years, it has been a traditional land of the Cayuga Nation, members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Today, this meeting place is still home to the Cayuga and Indigenous people from across Turtle Island, and we are grateful to have the opportunity to work on this land. With that being said, I want to welcome our guests today. President Koplinkoff here with us, and Mom as well. So everyone, today we're going to be hearing some of the president's remarks, and as well as some answers to questions that you have uploaded through our Qualtrics survey. If you would like to speak today, remember to raise your hand or your placard and wait to be called upon before speaking. That's all I ask. So please join me in welcoming our guests.
Thanks, Andrew. And please, you know, if we can make this as informal as possible. Glad to answer any questions or respond to you. I thought I'd just start with a couple of opening comments. You know, obviously these are very challenging times for universities. We're seeing some of the conditions that have really allowed universities to thrive, those assumptions being challenged in ways that we haven't seen in decades. Part of that is the partnership between the federal government and universities in a number of ways. That partnership on the research front has been a investment in research universities that has benefited the country enormously over the last seven decades, started with post-Second World War with Vannevar Bush when the government decided that all research wouldn't be defense research in the government, but would be fostered in this partnership with universities. We're also seeing some of the other federal connections to universities challenged around financial aid, access to students, commitment to diversity amongst the student body, faculty and staff. So all of this is new territory for us. We're trying to carefully navigate that territory, but almost every day we see new and different challenges. Fridays are the EO days, and we seem to get a new executive order every Friday. We do have a task force set up that's overseen by KB, Kavita Bala, that meets with all the key leaders around the institution to assess these issues, whether it's immigration, whether it's our own policies, whether it's research being paused, all of those things, trying to coordinate in a way very similar to what we did during COVID to try and institutionally respond as effectively as possible and try and maintain normal conditions and continue to advance as a university in spite of all this. I don't need to say it, but I will say that you know, part of this challenge is the assumption of universities that is core to our foundation around academic freedom and freedom of expression. And those are being tested in interesting ways. And there are some assertions that have been made by the government. We're, you know, I've tried to set out some principles by which we'll move forward. Those principles are first, you know, our core values of opportunity and access, the fact that Cornell is a place where anyone that is qualified can come and thrive. That's a core principle that we won't compromise. The fact that diversity is our strength, that's diversity in all dimensions, and Cornell has diversity in all dimensions, and it's something that we need to continue to foster and make sure that people understand that that's part of our strength. The idea that In all of our decisions, we are about excellence and merit, and we make our decisions based on excellence and merit. And then finally, that we are a nation of laws, and this is a university that follows the law. Now, a number of individuals wrote me after my statement, particularly on that statement, and said that, you know, saying that the university will obey the law is essentially cowing to illegal assertions. And my response is not at all. Saying that the university will obey the law means that we will also test whether assertions made to us or claims made to us are in fact lawful. And if they are not, we will challenge them. So, but at the end of the day, we do exist in a nation of laws, and we need to follow the law, not what everyone asserts is the law, but what we believe is the law. And you've seen, like on the Dear Colleague letter, there were some assertions around Title VI, for example, and I'm getting a little specific, but many of our faculty from the law school and faculty from around the country have challenged those assertions that they are pushing that too far and starting to infringe on free expression. So all of that is what I've tried to set up as the context in which we'll respond to these challenges. We're also at the same time seeing substantial financial headwinds. These started prior to this current semester, as we started to see the acceleration of costs at the university, the fact that we've grown our staff substantially at the university, both faculty and staff, over the last couple of years post-COVID, that our labor agreements have caused increased costs for the university, and now we're in a financial negotiation with our graduate students, all of which will layer costs on the university. At the same time, we're seeing some grants canceled. We're seeing the challenge of things like endowment taxes. There's a proposal to increase the endowment tax of 1.4% to 10%. Our the best information is that's the most likely thing to come forward. 10% endowment tax for the university would be something on the order of $70 million annually to the university. These are extraordinary challenges for us. So we need to be prudent. We've put in place some prudent changes to control our growth, to control our increase in spending, to appeal to people to try and constrain unnecessary spending. And all of that, I think, is important as we go into a period of uncertainty. I will say that I'm pleased that we appear to be making progress with our negotiation with our graduate student union, and I'm hopeful that that can be resolved. For a considerable period of time, we weren't making progress, and I sense that we're making substantial progress now and agreeing on a number of issues that are important to the university. Glad to talk about that. We will have a new expressive activity policy announced. I think Friday will be the announcement of the policy. It is essentially the policy that was recommended by the committee. And you've seen many of that. I know there was some concerns about that policy. We can also talk about that. But I do think it's a very thoughtful compromise around both promoting what is important for the university, that is free expression, difference of opinions, expressing those opinions, and protecting the core functions of the university so that people can't prevent those activities from occurring or create a hostile environment, et cetera. Maybe I'll start going through the questions now, because otherwise I'll get into some of what you've asked me about. But maybe I'll just pause here and ask if there's any questions on what I've said so far.
Yes, Dave, just about the express activity. So it's essentially everything that was in the recommendation is more or less going to be the policy.
Correct. So we went back and forth with the committee several times. There are slight nuances in language and some things, but there's nothing substantive in there that is different than the core principles articulated by the committee. Yes, Ocean.
Hi. You've definitely heard a lot from GBSA in terms of the express activity policy, but I think one big worry we have right now is that given the current political climate, especially with the many executive orders that have been being put out left and right, seeing which one sticks essentially from the administration's end and everything, a lot of it does have to deal with expressive activity. So do you believe that the expressive activity policy that you have right now, that you're going to be announcing on Friday, would stand ground in like conflict with, like, would it be able to like bend awe? Would it be able to like protect Cornelians from what executive orders may come our way, essentially, is what we're trying to ask?
Well, I think there is a tension here where, you know, individuals have asserted that their activities should be protected, even when those activities veer into infringement on others' rights. I mean, an example would be the employment fair at the Statler Hotel. When you shut down an activity that is an activity of a university activity, other students are engaged in it, have guests here, et cetera, that violates our regulations. That will violate our regulations. This expressive activity policy and previous expressive, it's largely governed by the student campus code for student activity. So if the assertion is, can we protect individuals from those who violate our regulations, I would say no. What we will do, and we have tried to do, is articulate a full-throated support for speech that doesn't violate other people's rights, even if it's offensive speech, even if it's one of the things that we've talked about is that that speech or expressive activity could technically violate a policy, but actually not violate the thing that the policy is supposed to protect, that is university functions, your right to go to a speaker and have a speaker and hear the speaker, that sort of thing. So if it doesn't veer on that, we've said, and I said in my initial comment with John Silcano, we'll be tolerant as we can, but we cannot protect unlawful activity. That's the bottom line. Now on the other side, I thought you were asking the Ocean if he looked at what Columbia agreed to over the past few days, whether this would stand the gaze of an administration who's very assertively articulating a Title VI requirements for universities. That is the obligation of the university to prevent the establishment of a harassing environment. So are our rules vigorous enough to be able to prevent the establishment of such an environment where some individuals would feel that they're threatened or harassed? And my feeling is yes, it would, that the expressive activity policy finds that balance between supporting free speech, free expression, but also providing the tools to protect the community when that goes too far. Long answer. Anyone? Yeah, quiet, David, sure.
I interpreted the question slightly differently. If the federal government came and said that this was an insufficient policy, required us to change it, would we say, no, we're not changing? And would we sue them? Say that no, we're not going to change it.
Well, I think if they came and said it's an insufficient policy, first thing I would ask is in what way?
Yeah.
I mean, so we would have a discussion about that. I would just point out that I don't believe that there is an argument that says this is an insufficient policy. It's in fact a policy very close to what Columbia just agreed to. Okay, let me just go to the questions. Maybe I'll read them and then just give a little bit of flavor of answers. With increasing external scrutiny on DEI initiatives, how will the university ensure that all students, regardless of background, continue to have equitable access to academic programs and opportunities? How does the university plan to respond to potential restrictions or policy changes that could undermine the institution's ability to recruit, retain, and support diverse students? So I would say that we are following the guidelines that I laid out, and I don't view our DEA policies as violating those guidelines or violating the law particularly. Now, I have to say we do have some policies in the university, as you look through a lot of our activities, that we may need to clean up. And I mean that in the following way. We have some policies that are articulated as race exclusive policies or gender exclusive policies. In other words, this is a program for women in leadership in business. That policy, to be compliant with the law, has to be open to men as well as women. The same thing for race. This is a program for students of color training in you name it. These things have to be open to all races, or they are illegal. And we have found, as we've gone through, I don't know that we've operated in a race-exclusive fashion or a gender-exclusive fashion, but certainly some of the language needs to be clarified so it makes clear that these programs are open to all. And you know, that to me is essentially what we get. And part of this is also making clear to the public, when we have these policies, what are we actually doing and what are we not doing? We are not really creating a kind of opportunity for single class of individuals based on, right, or thereby discriminating against others based on race, ethnicity, gender, national origin. So, but I don't see financial challenges here currently. You know, who knows what could happen? Could we be challenged by the federal government on our DEI policies and go through a process where we defend those policies? That could happen. My job is to be comfortable that we're following the law and those policies are defensible, and we're not in a position where they say, look, you're collaborating with an organization, for example, on admissions that's race exclusive. Can't do it, shouldn't be doing it. It's not legal. How does the university plan to maintain financial and structural support for DEI-focused offices, scholarships, and programs in the era which initiatives are increasingly scrutinized? So again, I diversity is our strength. Access is our strength. We are not compromising on any person, and that's part of why I wanted to articulate those principles. We don't see a reason, or put another way, we continue to view access and diversity as core to Cornell. Has the university been approached by any federal agency for names or details about international students or faculty? This occurs, will the university commit to letting students or faculty know as soon as it happens? So the answer, I can't talk about individual students or that sort of thing, but I will say we've had our policies on the web now. We make it clear that we will accede to legal requests, so we will demand that they are legal, and we will notify students according to our obligations under FERPA in a timely manner if we provide information. So that's a commitment of the university. It's you made it very transparent and public. It's on the web. Please go and look at that international website. Shall I keep going? NIH lawsuit and participation in legal action. What were the determining factors in the university's decision to join the NIH lawsuit? Who was involved in making these determinations? And how is this aligned with UNL's broader institutional priorities? So so for those of you who don't know, on a, I believe it was a Friday, we got information that the NIH was going to cut all overhead costs, indirect costs, to 15%. Our on-campus negotiated rate for the endowed colleges is 60%. The medical school, I think, is 69%. These are the costs of doing research. So the cost of operations of doing research that the US government has agreed to cover. We've negotiated the costs, we've audited the costs, they've agreed to cover them for the research that they agree to fund, which is about 20% of proposals. So if they agree to fund that proposal, they will pay the legitimate costs of doing that, which are, you know, light, biosecurity, animal care costs, the cost of overseeing all the regulations that are put on those federal government, the federal grants. And so we felt that this would be about $100 million immediately to Cornell. We felt it was not a legally justified effort. And we were, so the first two universities that stood as plaintiffs were MIT and Brandeis, because we wanted this to be a suit where there was a DA in a Democratic state. And then Cornell was the third university to sign on. Now, the question is, who makes the determination and how broadly do we consult? So this was a Friday. We worked over the weekend to get a lawsuit, which was filed, I think, Sunday night or Monday morning. It was very important to get this going right away. This is not something I'm going to come to the assemblies about or talk about, but we were very transparent about it. We announced it. We were very clear. We consulted broadly with leadership, provost, president, dean, president, provost and dean of the medical college, our chair of the board of trustees, of course, our general counsel. All of us collaborated about it. I was very proud that Cornell, when a lot of other universities were saying, no, we don't want to put our head up or do anything, Cornell was the one university outside of Massachusetts that said, we'll sign on as a plaintiff. Eventually, we got 12 universities. Many of them were waiting for others to sign on first so that they wouldn't be the first one to do. Yes, Ocean.
Hi. Well, this question's not, it's less about it's like current events and all that stuff, like the past questions have been and stuff, and a little bit more about like you and where you are right now and like, oh, well, that's a little dramatic. now that you're no longer interim president and now become president, I'm assuming that a lot of the goals that you've been and things you've been building up during your interim time has now shifted to something a lot more like longitudinal as well. So my question, I guess, for both you and Monica, you'll also be able to add in, what would you say are your biggest priorities or goals for your term as president? And where do you see any of the governance assemblies place be in order for us to support you in any way?
Yeah, thanks, Ocean. As people know, I was appointed as the 15th president over the weekend. There had been a lot of discussion about what Cornell needs at this moment. I've been here for 25 years. I've operated a lab for 20 of those years here as a faculty member, taught students, chaired a department, dean of a college, provost for 9 years. I think there was a sense that background and stability would be valuable for President Cornell coming into this period. I will say there was a lot of consultation by the board. One of my concerns was you don't appoint a president without consultation. The board went around, met with shared governance units, as some of you know, met with deans, met with faculty groups, met with staff groups, and met with student groups. And so all of that came out with their decision, which I'm very honored about to lead the university for a period of time. My goals are really, one, to get us through a very, very difficult period. And not just to get us through, but to, you know, make us stronger and focus on our four missions while we're doing that. I think I've been through a lot of crises. I became dean when we had the 2007-2008 downturn. It was financially a very, very difficult time, particularly for a contract college at that time. I was provost during COVID. I think there are opportunities to focus on core and make sure that you get an institution coming out of something like this as strong as possible. And so that's sort of my first goal, my most proximate goal. Secondly, we have some other challenges, I think, broadly as a university that we have to, and part of that is really unifying our medical college with our Ithaca campus and our Cornell Tech. I think we have real opportunities here, and we can operate much more efficiently in that. One of the things we need to do is really make an investment in our systems. Right now, if, you know, we have a different HR system at Weill Cornell Medicine than we do at in Ithaca or Cornell Tech. If you're a scientist running a lab, as I was, and you wanted to hire a graduate student in coordination with a colleague at the medical school, good luck. It's almost impossible for a single faculty member to overcome those hurdles. So we I want to make the institution more unified that way, etc. And I want to focus on our core areas of excellence at the university, really focus on faculty excellence over the next period of time. However, I'm here in the university. It's one of the things I tried to really focus on as provost, these radical collaborations and other things, trying to attract faculty. I believe in this place. I believe in the fact that we are different than many other universities. I came from University of Pennsylvania, where I felt things were much more siloed, and came to Cornell, where there's such a collaborative environment. It's what attracted me here. So those are kind of my overall goals. We also have some sub goals. We have some real financial challenges. You may have heard trustees with our medical school and our hospital. That's something we have to negotiate and fix. But those are basically my goals over the next period of time.
And just by way of introduction, I am still the interim, so I can't take that off of my title right now. I've been interim since January. Just by way of background, I've been in Cornell 3.5 years. I came from Penn, so I can attest to the siloed nature that Mike refers to. And I came here to run all the communications groups in university relations. So that's about 3/4 of our division. And so in the interim role, I'm also taking on government relations and the wonderful assemblies as part of our division as well. And it is a time of, as Mike alluded to, executing the strategies that we have now to get through this, but also developing new strategies for really a new world order for universities. We've seen much of what we knew to be true to be challenged from both communications standpoint and also just the landscape of public opinion of from elected officials to just public around the country, the feeling that there's a lack of trust, a lack of appreciation for higher ed. We're really rethinking how we engage, how we talk about the work that we do, how we demonstrate the impact of the work we do. I absolutely agree that Cornell is an extraordinarily special place. We have a story that others wish they could tell, and we have told it loudly and proudly for quite a long time, but there are new approaches that we are taking every day to demonstrate the positive impact that we have in people's lives across this region, across the state, certainly across the nation and the world. And a big part of that is also just engaging differently in Washington, D.C., as well as continuing the work that we do in Albany and continuing really important global relations that we have here in Tokyo's capital.
Let me add one thing, Osha, because I didn't really answer your question on shared governance.
Oh yes, that was
which I should have. You know, so I have been in leadership at every level of this university, and I've always prized the ability to be open and transparent and seek advice and counsel. Others, and I am a big fan of the way that Cornell is organized in terms of providing that input and counsel. And I think that we're all better if we discuss these things. One of the things I've tried to do, I sensed a little bit as I was first appointed as interim, I sensed that we had, because of all the pressures and the post-October 7th, you know, tsunami, we sort of pulled back a little bit. We hadn't communicated outside to the press very much. We didn't have a good relationship with our own press, with the Cornell Sun. We didn't have a lot of frank conversations with faculty, staff, students, alumni. So one of the things I've really tried to do is be accessible, get out there, had a lot of alumni visits, a lot of meetings with stakeholders, a lot of student visits, it was just at the Faculty Senate. Of course, my wife and I moved into Donald Hall, so tried to, you know, connect with students as much as possible as well. And that's all an explicit attempt to try and build a community that I think so one of Cornell's key strengths.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up? When you say engaging differently in Washington, D.C., could you specify more what you mean by that?
I mean, the traditional university sort of playbook is, you know, we have a team of we have our federal lobbying team, we have our Cornell staff, three-person office that primarily for many years has really focused on the New York delegation, on engaging with policymakers, on, you know, bringing Cornell faculty, students, our community to DC to talk about research, to talk about the impact of work, to come into settings and speak on behalf of their experiences. We have never really had a need to be engaging the way we are with like the federal the White House administration in this way, because this is really uncharted territory for higher education being a focal point of a White House administration and particularly agency work this way. Whether it's a state flagship, whether it's a small college, LaBarthe College, or whether it's, you know, other Ivy Plus institutions, this has come up pretty suddenly in terms of the approach. And so it's beyond the relationships that we already have and have fostered for many, many years. It's really trying to understand some of the impetus for what we're hearing from different agencies and coming from the White House itself.
And from the public. So, you know, we have survey after survey. We've fallen in the view of the public. Of course, all institutions have, but universities have, particularly so-called elite universities, have fallen the most. So there is a consensus, and we have an Ivy Plus, we've extended it out to other privates, particularly in red states, grouped together where we're all together coordinating, going to Washington. I've been to Washington, been to the White House, going back, talking to people and talking about what universities, the positives that universities provide to the country. One of the things that's important is that while there is a lot of skepticism about elite universities, about 80% of the public say that the ability of an individual from a disadvantaged background to go to a university and change their life is something that is an extraordinary strength of the university. So we need to play offense a little bit on the territory where we do have public, strong public perception, and get out of just playing in the defense of, you know, too left, too woke, too wealthy, too expensive, too intolerant, all that sort of stuff. Yes, Ocean Jonathan?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You both actually answered my question. I just wanted to know, is it Cornell that's going into the room, or is it multiple universities?
Yeah, both. And we're coordinating. We have a lobbyist we've all hired together. We have a coordinating, you know, program manager for it. We're getting data. You know, one of the things we try and explain is endowment. People don't understand it. You know, a quarter of our endowment is for financial aid. Another quarter is for faculty. Another quarter, roughly, is for research projects. You know, these are all things that people would support generally and lower the cost of tuition for kids.
So I want to follow up with one of the goals that you mentioned, and that was in regards to unification of La Cornell with Ithaca and everything else. And I guess I just kind of like wanted to ask more on what were your objectives or goals in mind in accomplishing that? And I ask this coming from a place where my previous institution was Stony Brook University, and then President McInnes was working really hard to unify Stony Brook Medicine with the Stony Brook campus, and we're like very close to each other and stuff. And I was there in the negotiation table for all that stuff, and there was a lot of pushback from the medicine campus, mainly with arguments of like autonomy and all that stuff. And a few other things that were kind of like valid and everything, so that I can understand from like the science stuff. So I guess coming from you, what would be the overall goals and that you hope to earn from this? And what are current challenges that you're facing or seeing from this?
Yeah, just really briefly, Ocean, one is, you know, we all have the same systems. Right now, as I said, we have different HR systems, we have different finance systems, we have different security systems, we have different student enrollment system. All of that makes it very, very difficult to get data, to understand data. We were in a situation where we were surprised by some events that occurred. And so we really need to have, I think, both from an efficiency standpoint and also to be able to facilitate faculty working across. I'm a little biased here because I've worked in biomedical research my entire life, but you know, also we have terrific sociologists, healthcare policy people here, epidemiologists that will benefit from that unifying collaboration. And so that's the real goal, to try and enable faculty to be more creative and to discover more. Jonathan?
So I appreciate this discussion. I appreciate you being here. Thank you. I'm reflecting about these intersection of some of these issues, and I guess I've often heard that Cornell has wanted to see itself as a living experiment, you know, in terms of trying to pave a path to demonstrate how things could be done well for others to follow. And also that we put our money where our mouth is in terms of the things that we believe and whatever. And you know, you were just talking about the importance of going back to these core values of merit and so forth. So another side of the university experience is this campus climate, and it ties to not just the expressive activity of individuals, but also the exposure to a diversity of thoughts, ideas, but also activities where people may engage to find things they like to do or not to do. And there's been articles being written kind of previewing the decadence of the Ivy League in favor of larger state institutions, like in the South, where students feel much more comfortable in the sense that ideas that are being explored by maturing individuals don't represent hills to die on all the time. And like, there's generally an air of you could have fun here too, you know, and make mistakes or whatever. And so some of this ties to the stress level baseline that kind of gets elevated when everyone is being all sorts of cautious and whatever. So I'm curious in thinking about our goals. I mean, certainly understand this idea of academic merit, performance in the lab and whatever, and, you know, classrooms. But this campus climate feature, I would love to hear something about how we can figure this out and do it well. And, you know, you've been here 25 years, you're saying, you know, can you reflect on, like, what it was? Has it always been this way? And just, we are just completely unaware of, you know, that it's always been this way? Or is there these trends that we need to reverse in a social way to be able to have a more tolerant engagement of diverse ideas, where somehow those used to not be the thing and now they're the thing? I mean, I want to know from your perspective, since like this climate, it seems to be a big feature that's not going to go away, even if everybody's performing very well academically.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what you're getting at, Jonathan, is this this notion that has been documented at a number of places. I mean, Harvard just did a study about this around the sense of self-censorship on in the academy, and the resistance to certain ideas. So you get into a kind of framework where certain ideas are not, you know, people don't feel comfortable expressing them, whether it's in their departments or in, you know, bodies like this. And that's an awful, awful thing. And for an academy, right? I mean, we should be a place where, as Carl Becker said, Cornell professors think otherwise, where you could say, you know, you could challenge dogma, you could challenge hegemony, you could just say, I don't believe that. And I'm going to prove you wrong, et cetera. Or, you know, I have a different view. And we do have to make sure that this is a place where ideas are respected and views are respected and speech is respected. One of the things that bothered me so much about this last Pathways to Peace, I mean, it really disheartened me. That evening I had trouble speaking because I did not think you could envision a Cornell symposium where people would come with the express idea of preventing other people from exchanging ideas. Now, you can say whatever you want about what the ideas are and whether you picked the right group or that sort of thing, or I want this idea, I don't want that idea. But the idea of suppressing sharing and exchange of thought is just anathema to a university. So somehow we have to do a better job. I have to do a better job in making it clear that that's just not acceptable behavior. And you know, people say, well, you know, they're passionate. They're, you know, that's it. It is something the public looks at. If you're comfortable suppressing other people, public says you're just intolerant of other ideas. And it makes us lose what is the fundamental basis. We have extraordinary freedoms at the university, freedom to teach whatever we want, to say whatever we want. And it undermines the freedoms that society has given us if we create these dogmas and say, no, this is not acceptable at the university. So I think that's what you're getting at. And that's certainly something that I've seen exaggerated over the time. It's not one like it hasn't been here, you know, for the last 25 years. But over time, I think we've lost that tolerance.
I guess to follow up, so I guess one of the things, you know, you started with was this concept of, you know, rigorous debate. But really, in order to do that, you need to have two sides, right, that are seeking to understand where they sit and then this is identifying this gap where we can't cross, right?
Yeah.
And I understand, like, there are people who want to disrupt that. But I think fundamentally, to practice that behavior, like, you have to have us, like, where are we being taught to do this well? And so I feel like that's an opportunity to put some resources towards so that people can be trained, because I don't know the environment where that's being happening.
Well, there is in Center for Teaching Innovation, that's happening. That training is available for faculty. In this coming year, I think Peter Lowen and the Arts College will start a required course called Disagreement, where people will disagree civilly, and there'll be that conversation. We've tried to put, we've added some of this in our orientation for students. Individual colleges have added it in some of their curriculum. But I think you're exactly right, Jonathan. I think we need to keep talking about what is a democracy, what are the fundamentals of a democracy, and how do we train people or prepare people to live in a democracy? Yes, David. So this is your expertise.
Yeah, so yes. This is what I live and breathe on. And so I guess one thing that I think Jonathan's points are well taken, although I wouldn't say that there needs to be two sides, I think there's just far, far more than two sides. I think that's all well taken, and I appreciate your response. But I guess one thing that I would like to see is one, you should celebrate the fact that we don't need a bunch of new institutions, although fine, good to have them. We do this every single day in our classrooms. And so we're doing an internal review for the government department. 90% of students say that they feel perfectly comfortable expressing any view in that classroom. We spent our entire time in those classrooms trying to get them to debate and to disagree, and to not think that this debate is the only form of disagreement. So we spend an enormous amount of time. I think you should celebrate that.
I do, David, yeah. But I have to say, the data I have seen is not 90% of students.
In
your department, but there are other departments where it is quite different.
All right.
And so celebrating your department, I'm happy to do that if that's the data, but I'm also concerned that broadly, it's very different. And Hopkins just did a study, you may know these data, where not only are people self-censoring, not necessarily because of faculty, but because of other students. And if you are on the right, you're much less likely to be comfortable suppressing somebody else's speech than you are if you're on the left. That was a data, nice published paper of over time. So there is an issue.
I'm not saying that there's not an issue. Yeah. I'm saying that we currently do a lot of work in our classroom.
Yeah.
And the faculty do a lot of work in the classrooms. And it is primarily, you know, it's a bunch of 19, 20-year-olds, and the pressures of conformity are real.
Yes.
And so stepping aside that is important. But one, we should celebrate it. And the second point is, and here's another piece. 90% of faculty who work, scholars and researchers who work on the Middle East, have reported self-censoring on the issue of Palestine to suppress their own belief about Palestinian rights, because they believe that there would be severe institutional consequences for doing so. Right. So that's another data point.
Is and it institutional consequences?
It's institutional consequences, career consequences.
I'm sorry?
Institutional and career consequences.
And career consequences, yeah. And public consequences. I completely agree with you.
So the encouragement, again, for you, which you've done already, but to continue to do, so this is not criticism, but an encouragement for you to do more of this, is to just bang on the drum of, one, our faculty will be protected for engaging in academic activities for their research, that they have academic freedom, and that university is fully committed to that.
Yeah,
I'm not saying you should go and like poke your eye in Trump's, like poke your finger in Trump's.
I agree with that. And believe me, I do bang the drum. Ross Brand is a drum that I bang almost there about. You can come to Cornell. You can, you know, he teaches a course on the history of the Middle East, and you have people from both sides of that conversation. You leave your politics at the door and you have an engaged discussion. He's done it marvelously for, I don't know, 20 years. But the other component of this that comes to me, David, is sometimes when faculty or instructors violate that that precious agreement around openness and stimulating thought and not censoring thought, and impose their politics in the classroom. So I don't know if you would disagree that that ever happens. I'm sure, I don't think you, but that's the outlier which, and of course, every time that happens, and it's on the front page of the New York Post or wherever it is, you know, the Academy suffers.
But it can be on the front page of the New York Post even when it doesn't happen.
That's true, true. I mean, it'll be exaggerated.
A close friend of mine.
It'll be lied, yeah, yeah.
Close friend of mine at, close friend of mine at Brandeis taught a course that then, the name of the course was drawn from a conservative book on Jewish Americans called Jews in Hell. So that was the name of the course. Classic book, very important. Kind of around sort of disagreements around this concept. They took the syllabus, they ran with it. It was in the papers. He was getting death threats, and his institution didn't defend him. And basically, just sort of like left him to the wolves.
Yeah.
And eventually, sort of walked it back. So I'm just an encouragement.
Yeah.
When that happens,
I hear you.
Draw the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just want to advocate for that position as well, especially for our newest faculty.
Yes.
So Avery August, the deputy provost, just held a session for assistant professors today, and many of them were voicing that vulnerability about not only just in the classroom, but also for environment right now.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Fair point.
Thank you, everyone. I fear we have gone over by quite a bit.
Oh. I only got through half the questions. So after you invite me back, I'll go through the other half.
Happy to. So yes, everyone, please thank President for the public conversation. Vice President. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The last one.
Yes, thank you. Thanks all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're moving back up in our agenda to approval of March 11th, 2025 minutes. If you could just look at them. Perfect. Do I have...
moving to previous question, since the current business is to vote on his approval.
Yes. So we're now voting on the approval of the March 11th minutes. Do I have... or?
Second to
the... Okay, perfect. The meeting minutes have been approved. Okay. Late additions to the agenda. Are there any late additions to the agenda that anyone wants to bring up? Nope, moving forward. Okay, resolution one. Supporting the establishment of campus-wide community restorative days. I believe it is, yes. So it is on the back of your agendas for your review. It is also... in the box. Okay. I think it's an update. Yeah. Okay. Christian, would you like to speak on the updated version or?
I didn't make the marked up version, so I'm trying to see if I can go through the history and point out what changes were. All right. So for one thing, we took into account the suggestions from the last meeting. You know, we changed it, so this is not just about student deaths. It's also including staff or faculty. We included those examples in one of the whereas clauses. I included a clause that sort of addresses the idea that while from one perspective it may seem that students are free to just like seek an exception to not come to class if they're affected by something, they are going to be disadvantaged because they're missing class, they're behind, and this and like that just sort of addresses like why we're doing this as opposed to just leaving it up to the students to find exceptions for themselves. Yes, there was also an acknowledgement I included about the potential consequences of taking days off of class, including for meeting like the required number of days we have to be in class with the state, et cetera. I think that those are all the changes, really.
To clarify, so this resolution one is not the final resolution one that is attached on the agenda today.
It's the current draft.
This is the current draft?
Yes.
Okay. Is it the
current draft? I'd like it to be.
Okay. Beautiful. That is perfect. Okay. Yes, Ellie.
Thanks. I'm still unclear as to whether these are university-wide days or whether these are going to be sort of more targeted toward perhaps individual colleges or units that are directly impacted by whatever's going on. I think I said something about this last time, but just to kind of refresh my own thinking and possibly what I said, because we're such a large and diverse institution, I feel like some of these kinds of events may impact more areas than others or more students, certain constituencies than others. And I guess I still have questions about the relative merits of a university-wide day versus perhaps days that are more targeted toward affected areas of the institution. Thank you.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, I think, to pinpoint like where, like if, for example, we try to shut down like one particular college for a day, there are students that are not maybe in that college but are taking classes from it that might be affected. Or like, I'm sure that student had friends who weren't in that college but are still affected, you know? And so, I don't know, that's kind of hard to decide. And at the end of the day, I think that's a decision of the administration to figure out. You know, I think the general idea still holds.
Thank you.
So I wasn't here. I think we discussed this at the last meeting, and so I missed that, I'm afraid. So maybe this was raised. I support this, especially given that the resolution is just sort of recommending a formalization of the practice. I do just want to raise my concern, and perhaps this is the pessimist of me, is I think that there's an enormous amount of ongoing trauma for different groups of students all the time. And so one worry for this would be that, like, ultimately, a lot of our students always are going, and different pockets of students are already going through experience of not visible or recognized trauma and would want that to be recognized, but the university can't recognize all of it because there's just not enough time in the semester to recognize the amount of trauma people are going through. And so that would lead students to feel even more acutely a lack of recognition of their own particular experiences. So that'd be a worry. I wouldn't oppose a resolution on that basis because I do think that that's something that can be thought through in the practice of implementing it, but I was just a concern to raise and thought about and a question for you and how you might envision institutionalizing or responding to that.
I would also like to echo what you mentioned as well, because I do see this resolution being very beneficial to the campus community overall and everything, but I also do see some other concerns that come to play with the legitimacy or like people's feelings of like being having their perspectives be delegitimized because they're not being recognized by the university as a means of getting the support that this resolution would essentially be seeking to do in the first place. Like, why is my struggle not being recognized, but theirs is essentially those kind of animosities, which could be unnecessary overall. However, the current state of fact is in status quo. The campus isn't really doing anything in general, per se, to help support people in regards to these dramatic things. And I think that this in itself should be at least the first step. And in terms of implementation, I'm assuming there may be some kind of a committee or something to like review things, just maybe more discussion beyond the committee anyway, to enact any of these that this motion calls for. So despite the things that I'm saying that are kind of against and stuff, I would still stand in support of this resolution.
Yeah, I think those are, you know, really good points. At the end of the day, I think, yeah, it's sort of up to the administration to decide. Like, obviously, this wouldn't be targeted toward, like, individual struggles, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, in the case that we had it last year, it was, like, it was affecting a large group of people on campus. And, you know, I think, yeah, like, that's a decision that needs to be made, weighing the, you know, the loss of the class day against, like, students' general well-being. Yeah, again, I understand both the points. That I've thought of that as well, but you know, I think this is just sort of putting it in the toolbox, because the what this is really addressing, I mentioned this last week, is that when we spoke to Dean Marla Love, she mentioned that this was, or she strongly implied that this was not something they ever wanted to do again, basically. And I was like, I don't know, like, they should never do it again. I just wanted to be in the toolbox in case it comes up. Like, I think last semester, it definitely should have been something that was used. So yeah, this is just, like, you know, something at their disposal.
I appreciate the spirit of the proposal. I don't like the language of the Resolution 17, but that's already passed because it basically establishes mandates and there's no discussion. And so I would personally rather reduce the concept of supporting the resolution, but maybe something that's in the spirit of the resolution, so that we're not saying we want those mandates. But I agree that the concept of saying, hey, let's develop a holistic process for which this could be an included component sounds like a good idea. I also think that this particular, like, the whole policy is reactive, right? Like, it's basically something that happened after somebody died or trauma has happened. And I would love to see the university wanting to have a system that's ahead of that, right? So, like, these things would never happen. And I agree we can't make it always happen, but I do think if you have a holistic process for which things are, you know, you tie those pieces together, it makes sense then to have this other one as a last resort if you're not doing something on the front resort, you know. And I guess maybe that doesn't exist, and so we could call for that.
Yes, Wendy, sorry.
Hi, I just have a question about the last whereas clause, where it states potentially including the establishment of predetermined limits on the number of such days per academic term and built-in buffer days. Is there, like, a set number that we have in mind? I mean, because there could be one semester that is way more traumatic than another semester. And, you know, is it like snow days? If you use them, then you're out, and if you don't use them, like, how is that being envisioned?
Again, I don't have the experience, I think, to sort of speak on, you know, like, what that looks like, because I don't really know what those limits are with, like, the academic calendar and snow days. In fact, it would need to be balanced with snow days. Because they, you know, both take away from class time, and, you know, one would affect the other. I mean, my idea was maybe just, you know, one or two days to set aside, and, you know, if it isn't used, that's great. But if it needs to be, I think it's just good to have there. I've always been a fan of saying that we should have shorter breaks and have interspersed, like, holidays throughout the school year anyway. So yeah.
Okay, so I have a quick follow-up. I have been at the university for a really long time, and you only used to have, like, one day for fall break. It was, like, Friday, or, like, maybe Saturday, Sunday, Monday. They extended that. So you're saying that you're willing to, like, take a day off of fall break so that you have one of these like a buffer day.
I don't speak for when I say
okay, that. But I'm just saying though, because I've been at the university longer than President Kolakoff, so I've been through a lot and have seen a lot. That's where I'm coming from with this, and I'm not trying to like be the evil one or anything like that, but I'm just saying, you know, and again, I fully support the spirit of this resolution. I just am wondering, like, we really need to have something set in place so that once it gets to President Kolakoff's office, he looks at it and goes, yeah, this is a really good idea, and he approves it, rather than just, like, acknowledging it or saying, yeah, but it's not going to happen sort of thing. And if we say, like, 1 to 2 days, fine and great, but like I said, what if there is a semester where there are all sorts of traumatic incidences that might warrant, you know, what if we use up the 2 days and then a week or a month later, something else happens? Again, we can't control what happens on campus, whether it's with a student or a faculty or staff member, anything like that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with it.
Yeah, I think obviously we can't predict how potentially traumatic or a semester might be. It's just, I guess, doing the best that we can without that sort of knowledge. But yeah, thank you, Wendy. I appreciate that.
I guess this is kind of a question for Jonathan, actually. So you say that you support the spirit of the Student Assembly's Resolution 17, but you're not exactly a fan of the language that's used. But because it's passed within the Student Assembly, there's nothing to change about it. So would you be amenable to a amendment to this resolution on the first be the final resolve, saying that the University Assembly echoes the Student Assembly's Resolution 17's call for community restorative days in response to yada yada. Not explicitly saying supports, but it's echoing the calls or essentially the spirit of Resolution 17.
I mean, I guess I just wish that it was paired with something that's not just focused on the days, but actually thinking about a strategy so that maybe we're hitting trauma before it turns into this need for this restorative day. I'm not saying that nobody has a plan for it. I'm just saying like that would look more holistic so that the day is part of a toolbox, but still might also be something else, because having a day off is a huge resource cost that might be better spent doing something on the front end so that there isn't so many of these, is what I'm saying.
I understand your sentiment with that, and I agree that there should definitely be more structure in general. However, I fear that if we were to introduce a specific structure for how this to be resolved, to be like enacted and stuff, that we unintentionally limit the implementation of this resolution. I think that at least having the spirit and the goals of what this wishes to accomplish, and then the implementation of it, be at the discretion of whoever the president and others that are working with to make this happen occur, would be more effective, essentially. That's kind of like where I'm coming with that, at least.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Erica.
Thank you. So my question would be, have we thought about, and I can't really get to the resolution right now because my computer is being weird, so I'm on my phone. Have we thought about how staff, all staff are not going to be able to have this day off, even if the university is closed? There are staff that still have to come and keep the grounds. Is there a floating day option in there for those folks who cannot and will not be able to participate in this, because staff do not have the same level of participation in things like this? So even when it comes to like inclement weather, right, if your classes are canceled, we still have to show up for work. So how are we thinking about how staff play a part in this, beyond just it being extended to staff as well, right? Because our function is a little different than faculty and students.
This is not entirely answering your question, Erica. I think it's just an additional comment of like why I, at least within GPSA, am more in support of this overall granted, with the way that this is written, it's kind of like a bit more explicitly obvious. It's kind of like leaning towards supporting undergrad students overall. However, I will say that as grad students who also work as TAs and all of stuff for undergrad students overall, if undergrad students in general are not doing too hot, that translates to the academic, like, you know, grades and everything, and that's a reflection on us as graduate students, on like how we work and everything and function of the university. And so in a way, while it's not directly like helping graduate students per se, it does help us in a whole like channel things and stuff. So that's like where the graduate student assembly is kind of standing on that end. Just wanted to echo like our concerns, because we also include the concerns from the employee assembly essentially.
So, you know, after discussion, I'm sort of very much drawn to the idea that I like the principle and I think the spirit is good. And I like how you describe it as sort of putting it back in their toolkit. And I think that that's useful. I just want to sort of endorse Ocean's suggestion in response to Jonathan's that we move it away from the language of Student Assembly Resolution 17, in part because I think it's just, as in principle, it's a good matter for us to not always be referring to other people's work. But also, I do want to sort of echo Jonathan's point about an encouragement for more proactive. Since this is all at the level of putting things in their toolkit, part of the resolution could simply be, and that toolkit should involve proactive thinking, so that any sort of decisions that are made about this and the implementation of it should also try to avoid the use of it by thinking more holistically about what we can be doing for students. Like something along those lines, which would then sort of maybe that final be it resolved would just sort of say, that we encourage, you know, the university administration formalize the practice of implementing community restorative days, but also think more holistically about how it can, forget the exact language that Jonathan used, but he had some good language that that I think would sort of be a good fit there.
No, I'm writing that all down.
Yes.
Given a lot of discussion about this and there being some needed tweaks for this resolution, I'm calling for a motion to table this resolution to the next university assembly meeting.
We'll entertain. Second? Okay. Resolution one is tabled.
Hi.
Sorry. Motion.
I'm still going to call to extend the meeting by 15 more minutes anyway.
Thank you. Okay.
So that the new ending time will be 6:30.
Okay. Thank you. New ending time will be 6:30. Oh, no.
We need a second.
Do I have a second? Yes. Okay. Do I have any dissent? No? Great. Okay.
I'm going to have to go.
Yeah.
I mean, a dissent. I know you guys can keep meeting, but I have to go.
Yeah.
I dissent as well.
Okay.
Wait, are you dissenting or are you saying that you...
No, I'm saying you guys keep meeting.
If you need to any actions, it may affect quorum. Is the point.
Do we have quorum?
Yeah, we do. And yes, it will. So you have to leave at 6:15? 6:15? Okay, let's try to be fast.
If we can try to get through the important aspects that are actionable before we automatically extend it.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, so moving on, resolution two, supporting universal access to menstrual hygiene products, also attached on the back of the booklet today.
You're muted.
All right.
Do you want to speak on it?
Yeah.
Is 3 minutes okay?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. This is likely not the final version of this resolution. There's some tweaks to be made. But again, the spirit of the resolution stands. I think it's very clear, you know, supporting putting feminine hygiene products in women and non-binary bathrooms, all gender bathrooms. Previously we had a program that was funded, I believe, by the Student Assembly, but that is no longer the case. And so this is sort of a request to the President's office to sort of find some funding somewhere to achieve this. The we're still looking at like what the numbers might look like for as for the true cost of this program. But yeah, I think that's all that it needs to be said.
The Lang 30 whereas clause.
Yes.
I don't believe that it is Cornell University's current provision of metro project is limited to select locations. I don't believe that I thought they were in multiple areas. So just
maybe that the wording was for, I think what I was trying to say was like certain offices use their own like funds for like their office bathrooms or something to have these products, but it's for, I think the gender equity research that maybe has them in the bathroom near them, but it's not like a campus wide.
I agree with Andrea. Some colleges actually support this, so you'll find it in their washroom.
As hilarious as it is, I do stand on the grounds of professionalism, and I'd like to make an amendment to this resolution to strike from line 50, Cornell Beach, right? Question mark. I'm making that motion to amend. Is there? I don't know if this is like.
That was actually, I did not come up with that myself. That was inspired by a program at Yale, I think called like Yale Beach, right? So, yeah. And I thought it was more. I'll strike that.
In brackets, because I'm opposed to the name, but because there's no need to have a question mark about the name.
It was a
draft. Strike the question mark only.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is stricken. Any other question?
I have a question about the last whereas clause about the costs. Given what President Kolakoff just said, that there's a potential that our taxes may go up on our endowment and we're in a hiring pause and non-essential expenses are being scrutinized. Any thoughts or ideas on where the funding could potentially come from for this?
I think that's definitely an unfortunate situation we're dealing with. I don't know like what funds are available or are not available. I think it's also possible to sort of try to implement it from at like a college level or you know, building level. I'm not quite sure, but
Maybe one idea is the student activities fee. I mean, that's used for a lot of things. So is that possible?
That came from originally. I don't remember exactly what the deal was, but
there's a long history I could go into, but you're short on time. But I think in general, it doesn't fit. The student assembly did find funds to get this project off the ground, but it doesn't fit the actual guidelines of the student activity.
Andrew, with all due respect, I don't think a resolution needs to solve that issue. If we want to put the resolution forward, the president can choose to put it forward or not. You know, I don't think that resolutions have to solve those funding questions.
Ellen,
Okay, thank you. I just wondered if there's any bridge between the group that's proposing this and Alumni Affairs and Development, because this also seems to me the kind of undertaking that could be supported through some kind of external funding, whether that be an individual donor or some other initiative. So I'm just wondering if that had been explored at all. Thank you.
No, I haven't thought of that. So thank you for that. If we were to sort of like seek out some alumni donor, though. I'm like, what does that look like? Not quite sure. Anyone know?
That's why I said I don't know if there's a bridge, yeah, right, already between, you know, between student assembly and AAD, but that might be something you could look into and see whether there is, you know, already a mechanism for that, or if there would be perhaps a development officer who would be willing to come and speak with you all about possibly undertaking some kind of initiative along those lines.
Okay, thank you.
I can probably be Christian.
Okay. Two things. One, I wanted to address the consideration of using the stamp debit fee for this program. While it did help out with the like piloting of this, essentially, I went to Stony Brook University and I was at the negotiation table with like bringing forth something similar like this to Stony Brook and also introducing it to the president's office as well. Because after doing a lot of calculations, sure, the stamp debit fee was able to do it for like almost like half a decade or so, but that was only half a decade. At some point, it became very unsustainable. While inflation is happening, while there's many things going on, and the student activity can only stay stagnant without having everyone complain and everything. So at least that was for Stony Brook's case and everything. So I can't say for Cornell's specifically. But if we want this program to be successful longevity wise, and also considering the fact that as much as this is supporting students overall, not students aren't exclusive to menstruating. Of course, staff and many others that menstruate. So I think that this program would be very helpful if it was like on a whole university-wide scale, because there's a lot of people that would benefit from this overall. And for the second point in terms of funding, I wanted to echo Andrea's comments on how resolutions don't need to solve every single thing and stuff. If anything, we can look at lines 54 and 55, which talk about saying that the Division of Financial Planning and Facilities would be setting measures in motion for this resolution. So they would be essentially working with all parties involved to make sure that this is actually possible, feasible, and to what scale, what degree, and for all that stuff. And there is a monitoring evaluation plan set in place as shown in 47 to 50. So I think that this helps out a lot overall with the bolstering of this resolution overall.
Table. Thank you. Do you have a second? Okay. Okay, moving on, resolution 3 has not been drafted yet, so we're going to pass that. Committee reports. Working on this, working on other agendas for next week's. Campus code.
That was not bad.
Campus code for committee.
Yep, that's what we did.
Site. Oh, it's not. Let's say no one. Assembly reports. Student assembly.
I don't know the last time you and I met. Like I can't remember the timeline. We've done things in the past few weeks.
Many things.
So many things.
We have so many things.
The most recent thing that probably is relevant to a lot of people in the room. Last week a recommendation was passed for the encouragement that faculty universally include on syllabi the grading schemes for classes.
Yep.
All right. Hi, y'all have never seen me before this semester, so now y'all have. I'm back. I don't know what we talked about per se from GPSA's end, but at least for our latest phase of this, we had our meeting yesterday. We passed 3 resolutions, resolution 9, 10, 11. 9 was establishing a special committee because GPSA has a lot of money in terms of reserves and everything. And there was not really a mechanism for us to use a good amount of this stuff. So we wanted to open the channels for us to accept any special grants from graduate student organizations or any other parties that's graduate student specific and stuff, to encourage there to be more ways in which we can make use of it and give back to the graduate student body overall. Resolution 10 was brought forward as well, and that was kind of mimicking the student resolution 37, which I was a sponsor for as well. And for resolution 10, I'm the only sponsor for it because 37 was a bit of a trial one, no tea, no shade. So that was to help call for Cornell University to protect the undocumented DACA, international refugee, and other immigrant community members
through the implementation protection of various programs, as well as through training. So there's that. And Resolution 11 is a bit more specific. It's kind of similar to Resolution 10, but Resolution 11 focuses on an individual specifically. I'm sure y'all have heard of Mamadou Tal in terms of like how his visa has been revoked essentially. And basically this resolution was to call for the university to formally rescind the statements that are being used to fund to fuel the Homeland Security investigation's declaration of revoking his visa overall. So 10 was basically the background, essentially like the overall arching thing. And 11 is like the specific implementation of the 10 essentially. Both were passed, not by unanimous consent for both of them, but by a vast majority, more than 2/3 for both. So that was very good. And yeah, that's it for resolutions. We've also been running GPSA elections overall. We have, as of right now, 12 people that have signed up for GPSA elections. With this, I can't legally say the most ever because I don't know that metric for sure. But I want to say that unofficially just to make myself feel good. And yeah, we're just running elections overall until we have someone to replace me.
Thank you. 6:15.
Well, didn't we extend it to 6:30? I thought I motioned and someone seconded and
we didn't vote.
Making the motion.
What else? Second. Motion to extend for 5 minutes?
For 5
15.
Minutes. Okay.
Oh.
What's your motion?
I was 15.
Well, we don't.
And if we end early, we end earlier.
Okay. Do I have a second? Second, thank you. Do I have to send? No. Okay. I know. Do you want to do your up to the really quick?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Faculty Senate.
Faculty Senate. President Kotlikoff, now President Kotlikoff, presenting in our Faculty Senate meeting. And we also have the vice president.
I bet you're
going to have more
talk about the video surveillance on
Sir Woman.
That was a good talk of me.
That was a conversation. Otherwise, for the past,
okay. Eric, are you able to give your update?
Yeah, I can give it.
Okay.
We had our meeting, our usual employee assembly meeting. We had the Office of Institutional Equity and Title IX come talk to us about how staff members participate in the process, whether they are advisor support persons or participating in the hearing panel. We also discussed our organizational meeting, which will be extending by 30 minutes because President Kotlikoff and VP Lovely will be coming to speak to us on that same day. And we weren't able to know that in advance. We were also talking about the TCAT work stoppage and how we can prepare ourselves for that and how we speak to our supervisors about really just giving grace where folks need that as far as like coming from outside of Ithaca into work, because we have a lot of staff that depend on TCAT to get into and out of the campus. And we also talked about the Presidential Task Force on Institutional Voice and how there is no staff representation on that at all. And so thinking about like how we are represented in spaces for senior leadership and what that looks like when we're not there. And yeah, that is pretty much our update. I can also give my other liaison update too while I'm here. So my liaison update is that we don't meet again until April 15th. So there's nothing new to report on that end.
Thank you.
Which liaison?
Lead Education and Engagement Student.
Ah.
Thank you. Okay. Moving on to liaison reports, Campus Planning Committee. Ellen, are there any more updates for Coalition for Sexual Violence Prevention?
No, we've had our spring meeting, and I believe we are not meeting again this academic year.
Okay. Dare I ask, Wendy, you're not able to make the games, but
Yeah, still conflicts with our meetings. I won't be able to attend the next one until April 29th. So by then, everything should be set with the benefits rate.
Okay. Cornell's Council Carbon Neutral Campus Steering Committee? Because that might be Adam.
That is
Adam. Or no, is that Zora?
No.
Thank you.
Are you in the campus carbon?
No, I'm the last one. Operations.
You're not.
Yes. Adam is carbon neutral.
Okay, so Adam is carbon neutral. Zora, Sustainable Council.
Cornell's Council. Okay.
That. The names.
So
all right. We have reached open discussion. Are there any topics for open discussion? Ocean.
Ocean policy during this meeting at 6:20 p.m.
Okay, this meeting has been adjourned to Wednesday, March 25th.
Yeah.
That's the point of that.